Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be chatting with Colin Anderson about Iranian internet censorship, as well as how sanctions on Iran actually led Google to block App Engine access to Iranians. And that's a problem for signal users there, because when the primary signal servers are blocked, the software falls back to a domain-fronted approach that uses, drumroll please, Google's App Engine. That's a bit of a pickle and a bit of an unintended consequence of sanctions, so we'll talk about that. It's a pretty wide-ranging discussion of internet censorship in Iran and internet censorship generally, and that one is coming up after the news. This week's show is brought to you by BugCrowd. Big thanks to them for that. In this week's sponsor interview, we'll chat with Keith Hoodlett, who is a trust and security engineer with BugCrowd. And we'll be chatting to him about some work BugCrowd's been doing on producing detailed remediation information for its clients. Too often, you send off a report to a security person who might not have enough AppSec experience to really know how to respond. Or on the flip side, the report goes to an application developer who doesn't really have the security chops to really get what's being reported. So BugCrowd has put its thinking, you know, they've put their thinking caps on and worked on some content that they feel will be useful to people in both of those categories. It's info that is tailored for various common technology stacks. Seems like a great idea to me, and BugCrowd's Keith Hoodlett will be along soon to talk about all of that. But first, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, the CIA in the United States has come to the conclusion, which I believe is not entirely unreasonable, that the Russian military was behind the NotPetya attack that targeted Ukraine. So we now have an official on-the-record attribution. Can't say I'm surprised by this one.
Well, no, it didn't make any sense as a ransomware campaign, but it did make some sense as an attempt to disrupt the economy of Ukraine. And, well, yeah, I mean, obviously the Russians are in the market for that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's good to see it, I guess, on paper. And, you know, because a lot of people, you know, weasel around these attributions a bit. And, you know, we don't get to see all the details of how they reach these conclusions. But seeing the CIA making this attribution, you know, I think will convince some people who perhaps weren't previously convinced, unlike the rest of us, that it was in fact the Russians. Now, what this actually means in terms of, you know, geopolitics these days, I don't even know. Like, what do you do about this?
I think, you know, campaigns like this seem to, it's not so much that they seem to drive the relationship between nations, but they reflect the relationship between nations. That's the takeaway that I've come up with.
Yeah, I think the other thing that stood out to me, like thinking about this, you know, rethinking about this morning, was, you know, this really wasn't their A game, right? I mean, this is, you know, just kind of playing with the ideas because, I mean, this, you know, was not a super sophisticated campaign. I mean, it makes you think about what the capabilities that they have, you know, what capabilities they have at their disposal, and the fact that they're willing to kind of experiment with something as rubbish as this to see how well it works, you know, in this case, targeting, you know, a country-specific software supply chain, so like the tax software from Ukraine that they use to distribute this. Like, that's an interesting trick. Like, that to me perhaps is the thing that they were testing more than, you know, really expecting it to do well or seeing how far it went, what all the unexpected consequences were.
But to me, it's just, you know, it's internet-based harassment, right? That's kind of what, you know, what this is all about. It's just, you know, same as them flicking lights in Ukraine, same sort of stuff. Speaking of Russian government hackers, apparently Fancy Bear is making eyes at, you know, online properties related to the, and users related to the Winter Olympics. And they've been having a bit of a crack at the US Senate as well.
Yeah, of course, there's been some historical, you know, in the last couple of years, argy-bargy with the Olympics and the Russians because of the various doping scandals in the country. You know, we've seen Fancy Bear, I think, sort of vaguely attributed to leaking some documents nicked from inside some of the anti-doping agencies and stuff. So, yeah, there is a continued interest in the Olympics. As to whether that means that the Russians are going to, you know, quote, hack the Olympics, unquote, as some of the headlines suggest, I'm not quite sure what that means. But, yeah, they definitely, you know, the Russians are definitely not shy about what they're doing. Or maybe we're just getting better at figuring, you know, joining the dots together.
Now, I want to call out some pretty shaky reporting in this week's show. I saw a Yahoo Finance piece titled "Very High Level of Confidence Russia Used Kaspersky Software for Devastating NSA Leaks," which Really, this piece takes a single unattributed quote from a former senior intelligence official, a single quote that says, that's a Russian intelligence operation, they've got a lot nosier than they used to be. And then this story proceeds to tie together previous reporting combined with lots and lots of speculation to sort of make the case that the Shadow Broker's material was obtained via Kaspersky on some user's computer, presumably Hal Martin or someone like that. But look, this piece is very weak, right? Now, it might be true, but it is a very weak piece, and I was a little bit dismayed to see it go viral.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting, I guess, on this really has been, not well researched because we don't have a bunch of good information, and there is a lot of kind of speculation. And yeah, I mean, in the backdrop of all of the sort of, anxiety about, about Russia and about China and about the way that the various internet companies hosted in those countries operate, I guess, yeah, there's just a lot of kind of background that's led into, this kind of, sort of fluff reporting that doesn't really have a lot to say for itself, but. By virtue of being, is Yahoo a reputable outlet still?
The thing that I have the biggest problem with is that they put very high level of confidence in the headline in quotes, which makes it sound like an official statement akin to what we just discussed when it comes to NotPetya. And, as regular listeners would know, we've been sort of advocating on this show for the US government to sort of put up or shut up regarding, allegations leveled against Kaspersky. I mean, my personal feeling is there's probably some truth to these allegations that we've seen floated in the press, but it would be nice to see people have the courage to actually come out and just say it.
Well, yeah, exactly. That would be nice, and I'm sure everyone would like to see that actually written down in a way that we could all draw some conclusions from it rather than being kind of left hanging like we are at the moment.
Now, these drongos, there's an Australian word for you, listeners, these drongos, Project Veritas, these weird people who go around doing hidden camera stings on journalists who, by and large, just keep saying entirely reasonable things, and then they use the hidden footage to sort of dress it up like it's a scandal. They've gone after some Twitter engineers. They got them, plastered and had them, sort of G'd them up and got them bragging about how they could read people's DMs and whatever. But if you watch the videos, it all seems, like they didn't really say anything that made me think there was anything inappropriate going on at Twitter, but it's turned into a mini scandal among your more extreme US conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a bunch of claims that they are making about how Twitter works, and they're trying to, feed into a narrative where, the liberal tech industry is censoring the, the poor conservatives or something, which of course is not really what, and when you read any of this, anyone is saying. And the idea that people could have their DMs read, I mean, Twitter is on the record of saying, we will investigate, we can read DMs, and we will do so in the course of investigating, abuse or, harassment, that kind of thing, or as part of, lawful requests. But the idea that they can just kind of willy-nilly read DMs is not what actually happens. And yeah, that's not what the person in this, kind of sting, if you can call it that, is saying, as you say, when you actually watch the footage.
Yeah, there's a few people sort of featured in those videos. One of them's a security engineer over at Twitter, and I found his Twitter page, which was funny because there was one tweet there that just says, well, this is no fun. And then, of course, hundreds of tweets under that calling him a traitor and, threatening to kill him and, all that sort of lovely stuff, as you'd expect.
Normal Twitter stuff, yes.
Normal Twitter stuff. But yes, Twitter has responded, of course, and said, no, we do not have hundreds of employees reading your, reading your DMs, and shadow banning is a thing we do to bots, not popular conservatives, and, shut up your face, basically. Is what they've been saying. Turning our attention to China now, and Apple is about to hand control of its iCloud data center to a Chinese company, which will have full access to user data as according to Chinese law. Of course, Apple is saying, oh no, that's not what this means, but you read this and you're like, well, that's what it means, which is an interesting development for a company that prides itself on protecting user data from the prying eyes of US authorities.
Well, yeah. In fact, even the terms of service actually specifically say that Apple and this Chinese company, Guizhou Cloud Big Data Industry, will have access to the data. And then obviously to comply with the law implies that the Chinese government will also have access, which, I guess that's Chinese law. What did you expect Apple to do?
Yeah. Oh, now it's a little bit far from our usual beat, but, you know, we do discuss it here and there. But yeah, there's been a wipeout on the sort of cryptocurrency markets overnight. I mean, Bitcoin was hovering around, you know, I think it got as low as about 10 grand. It doesn't look to be substantially recovering. So, and what's different about this one, I guess, is it's not just Bitcoin. It's like an across the board wipeout. So got to see if that one's going to bounce. But there's a lot of QQ on, you know, if you do like a Twitter search for buy and dip, you know, you see a lot of funny stuff, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the sort of the relationship between cryptocurrency and the security industry is quite interesting, because we've talked a bunch about how really high cryptocurrencies changes the incentivizations for hackers to go hack things and how they monetize stuff. So it's, you know, although that's not directly our, you know, we're not currency speculators, but on the other hand, it really does have a material impact on how security bugs are used, I think, which, yeah, it's sort of an interesting relationship.
Yeah. Speaking of Bitcoin, Krebs has a great little piece up on his site about how someone received a letter, like a snail mail letter, that says, look, I know you're having an affair on your wife. Pay me $3,600 in Bitcoin or I'll tell her. And, you know, this guy is not having an affair on, you know, behind his wife's back. So, you know, the obvious conclusion is that someone out there is just mailing these to everybody and hoping for some Bitcoins to come in. So that's an interesting little scam. Now, CyberScoop has followed up on a story that we discussed last week involving some, you know, industrial control hacking that looked pretty interesting, Adam. And I think we need to correct something that went out in last week's show as well.
Yeah, so last week we talked about this and about the story based on the reporting that was coming out, I guess, in late December, just after we did the last show of the year. And it was really, and I guess it's still kind of unclear, although more has unfurled over the last week or two. But yeah, this last week when we talked about it, I think I said that it had been found at a industrial facilities in the UK, which is not the case. It was actually found in Saudi Arabia at a company that has some relationship with Saudi Aramco, who of course are very familiar with being hacked. But yeah, this particular malware does not appear to be found outside of Saudi. And yeah, that was a thing that I cocked up last week.
But what else have we learned this week? It wasn't a big mistake, Adam. It's okay. But what else have we learned from this?
So this piece of malware, I guess, is interesting in that it's kind of like Stuxnet level engineering targeting very specific industrial controls. In this case, as we talked about last week, safety systems that are meant to provide cutout in the event that equipment kind of goes beyond its defined limits. So it's malware that's very specifically targeted and is kind of keyed in terms of how the malware decrypts itself to specific industrial equipment in the style of Stuxnet, and has a lot of, you know, good quality engineering in it. And of course, the suggestion is state-sponsored is a reasonable guess because of the complexity. The thing that I guess has changed is that this was being kind of handled quietly by Mandiant and Saudi Aramco and the actual company that was affected, but somebody uploaded it to VirusTotal. And then that, of course, has now been – it got pulled out of VirusTotal relatively quickly afterwards, but it got out, right? And people have been mirroring it on GitHub. And so the actual binaries that were found in the wild are now available for other people to look at. And, of course, that – because of the sophistication of it, does give people something interesting things to look at. So it might be a resource for other people looking to build their own. But yeah, the attribution of this is still very much up in the air. People are still trying to pull it apart. It's going to be the same amount of work as it was to pull apart Stuxnet, perhaps, as some of the stories seem to be suggesting. So yeah, if you're in the industrial control space and you haven't heard about this one, definitely go and read up. It's a thing you're going to be talking about for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of wonder, as you say, the attribution's all over the shop at the moment, but you sort of look at the nations that are capable of developing something this sophisticated. I mean, either it's one of them.
Cough Iran.
Well, I don't know, man. Iran's not, you know, I wouldn't have thought they were quite there yet, but maybe this is them arriving, right? Or maybe it's someone else. Maybe it's Israel. Maybe, I mean, who knows, you know? Yeah, definitely one to keep an eye on. So there's a link to that CyberScoop story in this week's show notes. Now, we've seen another spyware manufacturer, some samples popping up in the wild. Apparently, this company sort of picked up where Hacking Team left off, by the looks of things.
Yeah, it does seem that some Italians are building commercial-grade malware once again. We're not really sure if it's the same people, whether it's Hacking Team again, or whether it's the same people starting something else, or what's going on. But anyway, a piece of Android malware that is, you know, relatively sophisticated. Kaspersky's got a good write-up of some of the features. For example, geo-bounded triggered audio recording. So you go into a particular location, it will start audio recording, and a bunch of other useful stuff. Lots of integrated privesques and other things that you would like in your commercial-grade malware. But yeah, there's lots of Italian in the comments and things. So maybe it's a false flag. Maybe it's not the Italians. But yeah, Kaspersky's write-up, if you're interested in Android malware, is you know, well worth a read.
This guy who called himself Swartistic, Tyler Barris, this was the guy who called in a swatting call against someone he was having an argument with, like playing COD or something. And of course, you know, the guy had supplied him with a false address over the road or something. Police turned up, shot someone. He's now been charged with involuntary manslaughter and faces up to 11 years in prison. More details on that on Crubs on Security. I mean, it's a terribly sad story, and I just, you know, I hope this guy is given real prison time, because, you know, swatting is dangerous, particularly in the United States, where the cops seem, at least to me, as an Australian, to be on the trigger-happy side.
Yeah, this guy appears to be kind of a dick, actually. He's been bragging about how many other things he's swatted. He said he'd called in something like 100 different bomb threats to schools over the years. So, yeah, like, you certainly hope this guy does get, you know, a pretty stern sentence handed down at the end of all of this.
Yeah. Now, we've got a pair of stories here from Krebs, which don't quite line up, which is why I wanted to speak about them. Canadian police have charged someone for operating LeakedSource.com. Now, this was the sort of evil equivalent of Have I Been Pwned, where they would actually give you credentials that you could use to do, you know, all sorts of nefarious things. A 27-year-old from Ontario has been charged. But funnily enough, Krebs, about a year ago, did his doxing thing and sort of said that it was someone else who was running the site. Now, previously I might say, hey, maybe they were co-administrators or whatever, but it seems like Brian's misfired a little bit lately. You know, I want to say that as politely as I can, but, you know, is this a case that he misfired on his previous doxing attempt?
Well, it's a good question. Like, this guy that got arrested in Ontario, Jordan Evan Bloom, at least in the Krebs write-up, doesn't appear to have any real connection with the doxing that he did, you know, a year ago. I think the guy was Alex Davros was the guy who he decided eventually was in charge of LeakedSource. But yeah, you read, I mean, going back and rereading Brian's piece from February last year, like, you can see how he drew the conclusions. Like, they seem reasonable to draw from the information he had available. So I don't know whether it's much as a misfire as, you know, this stuff's just hard. Sometimes you're wrong, or maybe this guy wasn't, you know, the boss dude of LeakSource. Maybe he was just involved somehow. But yeah, certainly it's you know, interesting to go back and reread his doxing piece in light of what you know, the most recent information now from the Canadians.
Yeah. Now, of course, the FBI has a recently appointed director, Christopher Wray. He has picked up where Comey has left off, calling unbreakable encryption, quote, an urgent public safety issue, end quote. No real surprises here.
No, I mean, and there's not really any change in the current position of any of the participants in this debate, I think, right? I mean, people are going to have strong crypto. The FBI can't necessarily break all the crypto. They've got a whole bunch of phones they can't unlock. And, you know, obviously they would like to be able to do so, and they believe they have the legal right to do so. And we have to, I don't know how this is going to end up for anyone. But yeah, right now it is, quote, an urgent public safety issue, unquote.
Yeah, we spoke a little bit last year about proposed Australian laws. I believe that they're actually almost close, like the drafting process is almost done. So we might actually see some legislation on that soon, which might give us an indication as to where this is going globally. Microsoft is adopting Signal's encryption protocol for its software, which is really interesting because Skype has always been regarded as a very law enforcement friendly piece of software. So you sort of wonder if they've, you know, offered some other, they've baked something else in that might allow them to still access content, conversations, things like that to keep the authorities happy. Because, you know, as I say, the perception certainly is that Microsoft plays ball when it comes to legal requests.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's a very good question, actually. I mean, at the moment, they're only using the Signal protocol for messaging. They're not suggesting that voice calls or video calls or anything else would also be end-to-end encrypted. But yeah, no, you're right. It's a good question. I mean, the way that Skype has evolved post-acquisition by Microsoft, you know, this seems a bit of a departure, I guess. But then again, Microsoft full stop has been kind of weird lately, you know, contributing to Git and, you know, putting Bash on Windows boxes and all sorts of other crazy stuff. You know, 5 years ago, you know, we would have been, you know, no one would have thought that 2017, 2018 would be this crazy, but
yeah, it is. Yeah, Microsoft, big ship, lots of captains. So, yeah, it could be a little bit confusing. We also saw over the last week a huge kerfuffle over supposed flaws in WhatsApp, which is, you know, involving group chats, but the starting assumption is that you've taken over one of, like, WhatsApp's servers. So they're like, if you can take over their servers, you can, like, you know, add someone else to the group and everyone else can see that someone's been added to the group. But this is a huge security bug. And I mean, I suppose they're talking about some weaknesses in the protocol as it pertains to group chats, but it feels like it's been a bit overhyped to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in terms of actual practical attacks you have to worry about, that's not the one that most people, I mean, that's a thing that a nation state could do by virtue of law enforcement, or you'd have to go own, you know, Facebook or something, which, you know, it's not impossible presumably, but isn't exactly normal. So yeah, it's I don't know, I guess it underscores that people's understanding of what their expectations from you know, of security of these things are a little out of line with what's actually practical and realistic, I guess.
Yeah.
And it does show, I guess, the importance of, in the UI of these things, explaining what's going on to people. Like, someone has joined your group or someone has left your group and what that means. But yeah, they're not really
I wouldn't be throwing my phone into the bottom of the ocean just yet.
No, so I would not either.
I think that was approaching what you were searching for there, Adam. WPA 3 is on the way, which I suppose we're about due, right? Because while WPA 2, you know, configuration dependent is still pretty good, like, you know, these days you have to pay a little bit more attention to the configuration than you used to, so it makes sense that it's getting an update.
Yeah, there has been quite a long time coming. I mean, if we think about how, you know, wildly unsuccessful the predecessor to WPA was, like the web standard. Yeah, so
yeah,
it's,
that was
it's
fun.
Done way better than that. I mean, we had a lot of criticism for the IEEE 8211 group about the web standard and the fact they hadn't asked a real cryptographer to help them in that. Whereas WPA, obviously, they did do a better job of. And, yeah, there's been some issues lately, especially with the GTC mode. So, yeah, it's about time we saw a new development. I don't actually know what's going to be in WPA 3 yet, but that will certainly be something that I and a few of my colleagues will having a good read of.
But I think, you know, you've got to remember, too, that Wi-Fi, you know, at the time of WEP was this sort of new exotic thing. And the thinking was, yeah, you don't put anything critical – you don't make anything critical available over Wi-Fi, and then of course everyone just made everything critical available over Wi-Fi, which is why WEP turned out to be you know, completely not fit for purpose. But you know, I feel like we've got, yeah, I feel like we're on the right track at least with Wi-Fi security. Although, do you know if WPA 3 is going to do much to authenticate the actual access point that you're connecting to? Because that's the biggest problem with wireless, of course, is you can, you know, force connections to, you know, previously joined open access points. Have you actually dived into it yet?
No, I haven't yet, but obviously that is one of the key areas, like the binding of the name of the wireless network to a certificate presented by a radius server or the other auth mechanisms. Like, that's always been a weak point. But I mean, hey, that's one of the difficult things with crypto in general. Like, is naming is really hard. I'm binding cryptographic identifiers to human parsable names. Yeah, that's difficult. So yeah, we'll see if they add something for that.
Yeah, I guess I might have to go off and do a feature on that to find out. Now, we mentioned VirusTotal briefly before, and I should disclose too that Google has purchased some sponsorship around VirusTotal for the show, so just want to disclose that before we talk about it. But they've released a new graph feature on VirusTotal, which actually looks quite useful and cool. It's sort of like a Multigo-ish interface on VT.
Yeah, so you can look at the relationship between the various, you know, kind of command and control nodes and other, you know, families of malware, all that kind of thing. Like, if you have a ProVirusTotal subscription, you've probably already been playing with it. But yeah, it looks pretty cool.
Now, look, as we record this, there's a lot going on in the United States with regard to the reauthorization of Section 702 of the FISA Act. This, of course, deals with, you know, surveillance of upstream communications and, you know, things like PRISM and whatever on U.S. soil. So that's all happening. I don't want to get bogged down into that too much today. I'm probably going to cover that off in a feature next week. But just so people know, yep, we're on it. We see that that's happened. We've seen some more drama involving Intel AMT, Adam.
Yeah, there was a report over the last week about a way that you can turn on AMT, given physical access to a machine, because you can kind of turn it on via like the BIOS interface without like with the default configuration they have a password's admin. So physical access to machine, turn on Intel AMT, give the machine back to the person that you temporarily nicked it from, and then at some point in the future own them remotely via the Intel remote management service, which, you know, is clearly uncool, but also I guess quite a specific threat model, you know, sort of a very fast version of the evil maid. But yeah, a thing to worry about for corporate fleets of machines that have AMT, and if you can turn it off, then probably you should.
Lenovo just patched a pretty embarrassing one too.
Yeah, so Lenovo bought, obviously Lenovo bought a whole bunch of stuff of IBM back in the day. One of the things they bought was the line of what used to be Nortel switches. If you ever used IBM Blade Kit, they had a built-in switch that was actually a rebadged Nortel. At some point in the past, Nortel had added a backdoor for HP, which allowed auth bypass in certain configurations on the switches. Anyway, so fast forward many years, Lenovo, it turns out, is now selling switches that have a secret HP backdoor in them.
That so, dates back to 2004. I mean, that dates back to 2004. Beautiful. Chef kiss. Yeah. Mm. Basically. Oh, and I've seen a lot of people flapping their arms over some VMware criticals as well. These ones are like, ah, run.
Yeah, there's some bugs in, I think, was it VMware's vSphere data protection component, which is like backup and recovery for hypervisors. There were some path traversal bugs, and I think was an auth bypass as well. And
yeah, I mean, I got emails about this one, you know, from people who are dealing with it, just saying, oh my God.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's pretty bad. I guess it's not the first time we've seen, you know, path traversal bugs in VMware components, and they are bad. But obviously, if you can talk to the hypervisor and you can bypass all the security controls down in the OS's running within it. So that is pretty bad. And obviously patching that stuff is a super pain in the ass.
It's a super pain in the ass, especially when you've been dealing with all the Meltdown Inspector stuff.
I know,
well,
yeah, it's a rough time to be a cloud guy.
Yes, it is. And I think Tavis Ormandy was having a bit of a crack at some BitTorrent clients, which is, I mean, you know, talk about a target-rich environment, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, as soon as I saw Tavis was tweeting about going after torrent clients, I'm like, oh, God, I can't use torrents for a while. Not that I would for anything other than completely legitimate purposes like downloading Linux ISOs.
Linux ISOs, yes. So when you are requiring Linux ISOs with the transmission client, which is the default one actually on Ubuntu, Tavis had a DNS rebinding attack that lets you own people who are running transmission. And of course, yeah, I'm sure he's found similar bugs elsewhere. DNS rebinding is a well underrated attack tool. We've certainly used it at work in the last little while. And yeah, it's super, super useful, worth thinking about anytime you are expecting internal network services to not be reachable from remote web servers. But yeah, tough day for torrent clients.
That's right. And, you know, I would expect that if Tavis is diving really, you know, earnestly into this stuff instead of just having a quick look, I mean, you know, I'm expecting an avalanche of bugs basically in torrent clients, because you just have to use one of them and you're like, this feels vulnerable.
it's software
that is, the quality is so bad, you could just feel it. It feels dangerous. It's like when you're going for a surf and you get the sensation that there's a shark nearby. It's, I get a very similar sensation when I load a torrent client. Got a blog post here from Let's Encrypt, which, yeah, they had a bad time as well.
Yeah, this guy, Franz Rosen, was playing around with some host web services, looking for ways to own things, he came up with a bug in the TLS SNI authentication mechanism used by Let's Encrypt to issue certificates as one of the many, you know, three or four mechanisms available, but the net result of this is essentially on some cloud platforms where there is a front-end TLS proxy layer, you may be able to issue certificates for domains that you don't control. In this case, the two providers he tested are quite big ones: Amazon CloudFront and Heroku, which I think is owned by Salesforce. Anyway, he was able to figure out a way to issue certs for other people's domains, reported that to Let's Encrypt. They have actually turned off the TLS SNI-based authentication mechanism, and they're not going to turn it back on again ever because it's not actually safe. They're going to keep it enabled for people who are renewing certificates for some time, so as not to wreck half the internet that uses that mechanism. But yeah, really, I mean, on one hand, rough day for Let's Encrypt to... You know, I guess it'd be interesting to know how many people had already been doing this elsewhere. And three, I think Let's Encrypt deserves some kudos for actually triaging this very rapidly and then making what was quite a potentially, you know, a big decision, I guess, to just turn off this mechanism immediately whilst they figured it out and then to keep it off. You know, I think they get some kudos for really doing the right thing there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it looks like they were onto it very quickly and, you know, took it very, very seriously as well. So well done, Let's Encrypt. Now, our final piece this week, Adam, it is our skateboarding dog piece. As pretty much everyone who's listening would be aware, the sort of incoming missile alert was inadvertently sounded in Hawaii, leading to a whole bunch of people freaking out. I mean, it's just like we shouldn't laugh, right? Because people were naturally freaking out. But when you see... the actual interface to this system, you can kind of understand why the wrong option, instead of the test option, the actual sound, the alarm option was selected, and you can really see why that happened. This is the worst UI I've ever seen.
Yeah, this is certainly what you get, I guess, with software that's designed by a committee and then outsourced to the lowest possible bidder and then deployed with absolutely zero feedback from people who actually use it. Yeah, it really does look awful. And you can totally see how this actually happened.
Why don't you describe the interface for people who may not have seen it?
Well, I mean, the interface is imagine every website from about 1996 AD before we invented CSS, just a whole list of hyperlinks on a page with confusing names, and you click the wrong one and bam, everybody thinks they're going to die.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. So that was,
The other security relevant bit of that particular story was they were doing some interviews at the Hawaii like emergency management office where the system is run, and there were passwords on post-it notes on the monitors in the background. And of course, the passwords are also awful, but yeah. And that's how everything is formed that runs on a computer. Humble listeners,
it's funny, you know. You think about like how stuff is just cobbled together. I remember I can't even remember who it was, but someone tweeted like within the last month. They just tweeted a picture and they quote tweeted it saying "sigh," and it was a it was like a Shodan video, like a video feed they'd found on Shodan, which was just some web camera pointed at an RSA token.
Yep.
You saw that one, just so that they could like with zero auth, they could just go to that IP. And see what the token was displaying. And it's just like, that's an interesting workaround there, people. Yep. Well done.
That's what we in the industry we call an engineering solution right there.
There you go. All right, Adam, thank you very much for joining us this week to discuss the news. It's been fun. And we'll be chatting to you again next week.
Sure, Pat. We'll talk to you then.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Colin Anderson. He is an independent researcher who's been working on internet freedom issues over the last 6 years, particularly with respect to Iran. And he's just about to start a new gig. He's landed a one-year congressional fellowship via the US Tech Congress, which means he'll spend the next year as a staffer, working as a staffer in the US Congress. So no more interviews for him for a while. So we thought we'd get him while we still could. So yeah, Colin's been in the news a bit this month, taking aim at Google's rather rigid interpretation of the sanctions regime against Iran. Google has taken a hard line and blocked a bunch of services from the country, and that's had some unintended side effects. For one, the signal messaging software falls back to using Google's App Engine as a censorship bypass when it can't reach the software's primary messaging servers. It falls back to a domain-fronted approach. But because Google has blocked all App Engine access in Iran, it makes it trivial for the Iranian government to block signal, and that's probably not what the sanctions are designed to do. Now, that's interesting, but I wanted to talk to Colin about censorship, internet censorship more generally. As you'll hear, it turns out Telegram, too, is extraordinarily popular in Iran, and blocking it comes with political problems, the same as like blocking WhatsApp in Brazil comes with problems. So I've linked through to a story too about the Telegram in Iran issue in this week's show notes. Hardliners in Iran did manage to block Telegram for a while in the midst of protests there. But President Hassan Rouhani fought back to reinstate the service. You'll hear a little bit about the politics of that in this interview. Colin Anderson joined me to talk about all of this, and here's what he had to say.
Well, so the way that Iranians often put it is they have to deal with two filtering regimes. One, the filtering regime that's imposed by the Iranian government, and the other, the filtering that's caused by U.S. companies' interpretation of sanctions. And so what this leads to as an Iranian, if you're originating from an Iranian IP or have an Iranian email address, what you come into is a lot of the sort of basic services that you would expect, and really kind of underlying infrastructure is often no longer available because those companies believe that essentially it would be illegal for them to provide that service to an Iranian under U.S. sanctions law.
So what sort of services are we talking about? I believe specifically you've been out there talking about Google's App Engine.
Yeah, App Engine is a really great example. For Google, their interpretation seems to be that, you know, potentially providing hosting services to Iranians would be illegal under U.S. sanctions. And so as a result, what they do is they not only kind of bar access to administrative interfaces, something that they do for other services like AdWords, they also block all incoming traffic. So if you're trying to reach any site that's hosted on GAE, you'll receive a cryptic error message with a Google image on it and not any more information. This kind of broadly resembles what it's like. A lot of the services that you would encounter, such as application stores, like Adobe Flash, they're blocked for Iranian visitors because of these sanctions.
Mm. Some people might be thinking, so what, right? But then you start factoring in things like, you know, Signal using App Engine for certain types of traffic, right? Now, does Signal always use App Engine, or is this only when it's configured to use some sort of domain fronting obfuscation communication protocol? Communication technique,
As I'm aware, Signal only uses the domain fronting when the front-end services aren't available. So it tends to use this as a backup mechanism in case the Signal properties are blocked.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that would like automatically fall back to App Engine. Now, I'm going to take a wild guess here and imagine that the Iranian regime has probably blocked the front-end servers for Signal. Is that correct?
Yes. Sometimes they're blocked, sometimes they're unblocked. What you'll tend to find with Iran is that the filtering regime is very kind of time driven. And so especially around occasions of protests or around elections, things are quickly ramped up. And then what you see is when the regime thinks that it has greater control over the situation, it'll eventually scale these things back in order to maybe not necessarily keep up the social pressure over the long term.
So it really is the case that, oh, okay, there's going to be a whole bunch of protests happening. Exactly. Let's restrict the ability of these people to coordinate their actions.
Yes. Or what you'll see is, for example, a service might be advertised on a diaspora television channel, and that television network might be using it in order to, for example, receive reports of protest or mobilize campaigns such as protesting the mandatory veiling of women. And when that becomes politically sensitized, when it becomes kind of wrapped up with the social movements, when Signal is put out there as a subversive mechanism, that tends to attract their attention more than anything else.
Now, that leads me to my next question, which is, what is the actual use of Signal like in countries like Iran? Because I feel that sometimes we just make these assumptions that these tools that we all know and love, that they're sort of universally popular everywhere, but that's not always the case. Do a lot of Iranians use Signal? Is it important to people who are organizing protests there?
Well, if you look at things like Tor and Signal, they definitely have their demographic. And their demographic is people who are very security conscious. I wouldn't say that they're necessarily first tier. They get used kind of for more fundamental basis, but they're a lot more technologically savvy individuals. If you take Signal in comparison to Telegram, it's not even close. Telegram, however, in comparison is basically the entirety of the internet for Iran. And so while people actually are using Telegram in Iran for security purposes, it's really, it's turned into to the way that they talk, individuals talk to their family members in the diaspora, the way that news media pushes out content. And so it's really, I think, important to kind of place that distinction between Telegram and Signal.
Now, Telegram is known to have some issues, particularly when it comes to group chats. So I'd imagine that for organizing protests and whatnot, it might not be the safest choice. Is that a fair assumption?
It might not be the safest choice, but you know, a lot of what people are doing is not necessarily things that they perceive as subversive or one-to-one communications. I think it's important to also kind of consider Telegram not just as a replacement for Signal, but also as a replacement for Facebook or for Twitter. People are trying to push out content from many to one, or from one to many. And in that case, what you're getting into, this sort of cryptographic weaknesses, the opacity of Telegram and other such issues, you know, though that's maybe not the primary concern. Your primary concern might be something like infiltration, right? Or somebody turning over information. And at that point, that's not a cryptography issue. That's like an operational security issue.
Yeah, look, I can remember from days working on Ricochet, like that, you know, the many-to-many thing is basically an unsolvable problem, right? Because it only takes, you know, one person strapped to a chair being belted over the head for a while before, guess what? They're in your group. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but it's the rubber hose issue. Yeah, it's the rubber hose issue, right, from way back. So why is it the government in Iran is not clamping down on the use of Telegram?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about the protests that occurred over the past couple of weeks is this is one of the first times that they actually have clamped down on Telegram. And the reason why they haven't thus far is because, you know, the user base in Iran is believed to be, of Telegram, is believed to be 40 million. And so this is a country of 80 million people, maybe 60% connectivity. So what you're looking at is the vast majority of Iranians use this application. And there have been numbers thrown out that say that that Telegram is potentially 40% of Iran's internet traffic. And so when you start to consider those numbers, this is the primary mode of communication. For the Iranian president, you know, what he ran on is a campaign of like social liberation, of social reform. He hasn't necessarily won in that. But what he did promise is a reduction of internet censorship. And so what you have is a situation in which a moderate president is fighting the hardline establishment. And about the only thing that he can win on is not necessarily getting services blocked. This is his social reform agenda. Mm.
It is political. I've seen the same thing in Brazil, where I've been there a couple of times when courts have blocked WhatsApp, man, and the country stops. No one uses SMS because their telcos have hideous reliability problems with message delivery. I could recall being involved in an insurance claim over there where we were instructed to send the photos to the insurance company via WhatsApp. It is how commerce is conducted. It is how people organize their lives, right? So you block it and people get pissed off. Right, so I'm guessing it's the same sort of dynamics are at play in Iran. If you want to ensure a revolution, block Telegram, and everyone's going to get the shits.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, look, just going back to the Signal thing, you say also that it would be possible for Google to whitelist the delivery of services like, you know, censorship bypasses, like Signal. They could whitelist Signal for use within Iran without necessarily falling afoul of sanctions. Is that correct?
Certainly. There, and one thing to keep in mind is that despite the U.S. sanctions regime, which basically prohibits everything, access to internet is one of the rare places in which there's kind of uniform consensus that this is good. This is good policy. And so what we have is that one of the few exemptions that exist in this overall broad block against Iran is you can actually offer up information technology services. You can't sell a toaster to Iranians, but you can sell them an iPhone. And so these exemptions also would potentially allow Google to make available these services like whitelisting Signal.
Mm. To what degree does that matter, though, when really not many people are using it? Do you think we might be sort of focusing too much on the wrong issue when it comes at least to Signal in Iran?
I think one of the biggest concerns for human rights organizations is that the Iranian government has maintained this strategy that they call the national internet. And really, that's just simply them trying to push domestic services. And so what they want is if Telegram is blocked, they want people to turn to domestic alternatives that aren't encrypted, that are subject to a subpoena and compliance requests. And so there's a real danger that if Telegram goes away, that people aren't necessarily going to use VPNs to access Telegram. What they'll do is they'll turn to the domestic alternative. And so it's very important to have these safe and secure alternatives that are more resilient to blocking, because you know the idea that that Iranians are going to start to trust domestic providers is deeply concerning.
Well, I mean, this is straight from the Chinese playbook, right? Because that's exactly what China does. They block everything that's not friendly to their needs, and people will just use it because people will go for the convenient solution. One thing that I find very interesting about all of that, right, is that I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what people think the Chinese do and what they actually do. So domain fronting is a great example, right? So we're talking about Iran now, not having access to Google's app engine or whatever. But friends of mine who spend a lot of time in China, they say that if they start using domain fronting techniques to bypass the Great Wall, they pick it up on the wire and then bang, they won't be able to access Amazon, Google, you know, any of these sort of domain fronted methods. Like they can't access CDNs. If the network detects them using domain fronting, they just get blocked from anything that can use domain fronting and they have to go to another connection. I mean, it's a curly problem, right?
Certainly. It's also an economic one. To go back to what I mentioned, what we tend to think of as censorship as a static condition, but in reality, what time has shown is that it tends to be very time driven, right?
It's about disruption.
It's about disruption at the moment in which you need it most. And so what domain fronting tends to rely on is less technical resilience and more economic arguments, making it so costly that somebody is unwilling to block Akamai. But I have to say that if you're an authoritarian regime and you're at a place in which you're facing substantial threats to your stability, a couple million dollars of economic damage for blocking Akamai over the course of a couple of days is something that you're probably going to be willing to pay. And so what I'm getting at is
what happens in China is they're actually doing CDN and like app engine blocking per user based on what they're detecting on the wire, right? So that is, they're not blocking it for everyone. They're just blocking it for that user because they're like, whoop, this looks like domain fronting. See you later.
Certainly. And I would say that China tends to be atypical in the level of sophistication that they have. I think that the model that you might see more commonly for other regimes, which is equally as applicable to showing how kind of fragile this method is that a lot of countries are willing to block Akamai for a couple of days. Yes, you can get to the place in which you do basically fingerprinting of people that are doing domain fronting, but in other cases, it's perfectly fine if you are like the Egyptian government or the Iranian government, and there are street protests and you are potentially going to have your regime toppled, you're going to be more than willing to turn off access to Google for a couple of days if it means that might save you from being overthrown.
So that's why I sort of suspect that a lot of people who are real champions of, technologies that can be used to bypass censorship regimes don't necessarily get that, do they? Do you feel there's a bit of a disconnect between the idea of Western digital activists, the ideas that they have about effective techniques for bypassing censorship versus the reality on the ground where you're dealing with regimes that go, oh, we're just going to block Amazon today?
I think that there is. I think that there's a gulf. I think that that's though also the interest in domain fronting is driven by the fact that there are very few options. We have limited IPv4 space. You have an improvement to deep packet inspection and a proliferation of DPI, so that it's quite common. It's no longer sort of a sensitive technology that's hard to get a hold of. And so as a result, for the censors, I think it's becoming increasingly easy to engage in censorship. So people are just basically grasping for whatever opportunity kind of buys time, buys some access, and there are very few other options.
So where does this leave us in terms of fighting, regimes that engage in censorship? Because it just really feels like if you're dealing with a government that halfway has its shit together, you're going to lose.
I think that China Don't becomes dystopic, right? And I think that the benefit is that there, the one cause for optimism is that China has enough people, China has invested enough resources, was early enough to start to close off to the rest of the world. other countries such as Iran don't necessarily have that. They haven't been been as successful in fostering domestic alternatives. That doesn't mean that we should, you know, hope for Google to be the savior of internet freedom, but it does mean that there are still considerable kind of economic, strategic, operational difficulties that other countries are going to face in kind of approaching the China model. It's kind of like this. There are often computer science papers that say, look, we've figured out a way of doing fingerprinting of this pluggable transport for Tor. And if you only kind of look at the timing of packets...
Yeah, I've read that paper on Meek Transport as well.
Yeah, there's a couple of those, right? But when you know, it kind of comes out and it's like, oh, Meek is broken, or this Skype-looking thing is broken. But when you start to think about doing that at a national scale in real time and in a capacity that doesn't completely block your network, that becomes incredibly more costly and difficult to do. China is what everything is 15 years from now, right? And it is what everything could be in the, you know, kind of maximalist ideal situation as far as pursuing that dystopia. If you're a democratic activist in some of these countries, what you're really taking advantage of is that a lot of these governments don't have their shit together to the same extent as China.
And, you know, I would never expect Telegram to be the silver lining in a conversation, but it seems like if you've got so many tens of millions of people in Iran using it, it's going to be very politically difficult for a government to block that without further fanning the flames. Because, you know, I'm just thinking average people, all of a sudden, you know, their primary method of communication goes dark. They're more likely to side with the protesters under that scenario than the government.
And I think that you did well at saying that this speaks to some of the misconceptions about how censorship and the politics around censorship occur. The primary protection of freedom of expression in even a country like Iran is not technical. It's not domain fronting. It's not
ops political.
Proxy.
Yeah, it's WhatsApp in Brazil.
It's political.
Yeah,
social. It's
absolutely. Well, look, Colin, that was all very interesting stuff, mate. We appreciate you taking some time to discuss it with us here on the show. Good luck on your new gig, and I'm sure we'll be chatting to you again in the future.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
That was Colin Anderson there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Keith Hoodlett, a trust and security engineer at BugCrowd. Keith and his colleagues have been working on providing better remediation advice to companies that run bug bounty programs through BugCrowd. The idea being that instead of just dumping a researcher's report on someone's desk, I don't think they ever really did that, but you know, instead of just dumping a raw-ish report on someone's desk, they can now supply some remediation steps tailored to that customer's stack, which seems like a really good idea. Here's Keith Hoodlett.
So what we've done is we've gone ahead and looked at our data set across several hundred customers and the kind of findings that have been produced for those customers. From there, what we've done is we've said, based on the following development stacks, so if you're using like maybe a Python Flask stack or Ruby on Rails or what have you, based on the finding that has come in and the development stack that you're working in, we can provide the kind of advice to let your developers know how better to remediate that finding, how it was produced, some additional information as to resources that they might use. And then, of course, from our actual application security engineers that work at BugCrowd and their experience from the development and the application security side of the house, what sort of auxiliary recommendations or feedback they have to perform that remediation.
Now, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as they say. And this leads me to my next question, which is, how hard is it to actually provide a level of advice that's detailed enough to be useful, but generic enough not to be misapplied? Do you know what I mean? Like, creating generic remediation advice is usually pretty hard. Like, was that the challenge when you were creating this content?
Definitely. And so to the extent that thankfully, you know, we have a large enough data set where we can look at these things. And of course, the same advice doesn't apply everywhere, right? So if you have a SQL injection attack against a given page, say it's a WordPress site, for example, depending on how they've actually got that SQL injection in place, that could be fairly unique to our customer set, right? Like, it's not going to be 100% perfect. But to the extent that we understand how SQL injection works and we can give them recommended feedback on, okay, use an object relational mapping tool here, which should solve some of these problems depending on what the code actually looks like. Because again, we're doing black box testing. We don't know what it looks like.
Yeah, but that's the tough part, right? Like,
Right. We can give good general advice to customers. And to some extent, we can get more specific if we have a better understanding of that development stack or that framework that is perhaps fairly standard, as in the case with WordPress.
Now, is this content designed to be consumed by security people or developers or both? Because, you know, I did a thing on the OWASP Top 10 last year, spoke to a bunch of very smart people about that, and they felt that, you know, a lot of OWASP's content was sort of speaking to security people, not so much developers. And, you know, the security industry needs to do a slightly better job of learning the language of developers. So where have you actually pitched it? Like, you know, who's the intended reader of this information?
So it's definitely geared toward developers in terms of allowing them to then take the information that's been provided by the researcher, look at the remediation advice to get a better understanding if the researcher hasn't been fully clear as to how that came about.
In a bug bounty, that would never happen.
I mean, thankfully, our researchers, especially our top researchers, are providing really detailed findings and are, of course, communicative in terms of answering any questions that other developers or the security folks might have. But to that end, I would say that if there has been any sort of gray areas or question marks from the researcher side, that remediation advice allows the researcher to get a fuller understanding. And of course, they still have the ability to ask more detailed questions of the researchers anyway. So to that end, I would say that this is definitely geared toward developers, but of course, at the end of the day, security is usually who runs or owns this tool. If they don't happen to understand the problems that are in place, because let's face it, there aren't enough application security people to go around. So sometimes it's been a security engineer who's running the firewall that also is running this program.
I was just about to say that. It's like the person with the checkpoint type in who is all of a sudden running the bug bounty program.
Yeah. And I mean, you see that more and more these days where they're just, again, there's not enough security people to go around. So helping them to understand what this problem is, how it presents itself. And of course, with things like our vulnerability rating taxonomy, we've made it easy to understand the impact of findings, but that doesn't always mean that it's easy to then communicate that information internally. So this sort of remediation advice is going to help those people speak about this intelligently with their development team, if in fact, you know, they're interacting with them directly.
Have you had much feedback on this so far? Because I understand that this is something that you've just started shipping, you know, like with reports, this information. Is it something that you've had feedback on?
So I haven't actually been involved at that level in terms of working directly with the application security engineers. From everything I've heard, it's somewhat, you know, a few layers out, it's had very positive reviews from the customers that have been using it, to the extent that it is one of those things that it's private between the company and BugCrowd's application security engineers. It's not going to be something that's shared directly with the researchers. Those companies that have been leaning on us to help them shore up their security have seen this and say, yeah, the hardest or the most friction points we have in our organization is getting the developers to fix things. This makes that easier, which at the end of the day means patches or fixes get pushed and everyone's hopefully happy at the end of the day.
Is this a resource that you think you will eventually make available to the wider internet, or is it just going to be, you know, in your reports to customers?
Well, so right now it's very specific to the findings as they come through. So I don't know if we're going to make this sort of like the, you know, OWASP Top 10, but the BugCrowd version of here's the kind of findings that you need to understand how to remediate and based on like our metrics. I don't know if we're going to go that route or not, but to the extent that it's definitely somewhat more specific to the findings as they come in and get triaged by our application security engineers, that's currently an in-house thing. Stay tuned on that part.
So, yeah, I mean, we often hear that security people are supposed to be, you know, as all of my friends in application security say, you know, they're supposed to be moving left, you know, and getting a deeper understanding of the issues involved at the application security layer. We were speaking earlier and you say that it's possible, just possible, that some of these people who are moving left are kind of missing some stuff. What is it that they're missing as they're trying to grapple with the issues around development?
Sure. So I think that the biggest thing that a lot of companies are missing as they shift left with SAST or DAST tooling is simply the pace at which new frameworks and libraries are growing, expanding, and changing. So at some point, someone actually has to develop a check for different kinds of vulnerabilities in, say, the AngularJS or Angular 2 stack or React or what have you. And especially in modern web development, with the rise of JavaScript and Node.js, the testing methodologies around that are still somewhat, in their infant stages. And so even if you have a SAST or a DAST tool that is actually scanning your application on a regular basis, as your developers are introducing new feature sets, new frameworks and libraries, you're missing a ton of those things that you're otherwise going to get in a bug bounty program through actual human testing. Because again, someone's got to build the test for it. And more often than not, those tests probably don't exist just yet for the tools you're using.
So I think you're saying the thing people are missing is that it's hard to keep up.
Yeah, exactly. I have a DAST tool and a SAST tool. I'm fine. But they never actually validate that those tools are doing everything that they need to then give them bulletproof security, which of course is more or less a myth to some degree. But then again, to the extent that bug bounties can certainly find a lot more of those things that are being missed, it happens every day.
It's the incentivization, right? Because if you find something that's like framework wide, if you find something dumb people are doing with a new framework feature as a bug bounty hunter, you can go and hit up 10 programs and claim rewards from all of them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, there's a few folks over at Portswigger, so the makers of Burp Suite Pro, who have done that kind of research. I mean, I think he goes by Albino Wax, James Kettle, did just that.
Yeah, this he was on the show last year.
Yeah, I believe so. He presented on the show on just that. He took some research that he was doing, and exactly that. He hit up something like, I don't know, several bug bounty programs and came away with something like $30,000 in bug bounty money, which, believe it or not, he actually donated a lot of that. I think he bought some beers for the office and then donated the rest to charity, which I think is really great.
That is great. I was remembering too that I interviewed someone who's, you know, very much an expert on OAuth 2. And at the time there were a few common implementation bugs he just made a fortune off that. Right. So you're right. Like you're more incentivized than the makers of the SAST and DAST tools when, you know, you're a bug bounty person, because it's like, you know, bug goes in here, cash comes out there. Right. So it is, it's a good way to find them.
And not to mention, too, I mean, we see this all the time with new vulnerabilities as they come out, right? As soon as a new vulnerability class or category comes out, the researchers are looking for ways to actually leverage that back into bug bounty programs that they're either currently researching on or in terms of just developing their skill sets for future use in bug bounty programs. So to the extent that people are looking at these Meltdown Inspector bugs and saying, oh, it's executable via JavaScript, can I leverage this into a bug bounty program or not? Remains to be seen. But then again, it's one of those things that I'm sure someone is thinking about it somewhere.
Yeah, someone's trying to scrape some memory somewhere and see if anything critical falls out, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you have an open, for example, if you have an open redirect bug off of your website, right, and suddenly you can fish people into going to your page, getting an open redirect, and now going to a page that I'm controlling that's using malicious JavaScript to grab memory out of your system, I would not be surprised if we start to see like targeted phishing campaigns that try to do just that.
Yeah. The browser makers have fixed that one, so that's a pretty small window there, and closing fast, I suspect. Now, also, Keith, I wanted to mention that you have just started doing a podcast with Paul Assadorian over at Security Weekly. This is a podcast entirely dedicated to application security, is that right?
It is, yes. So we're actually recording what is episode 2, the third episode. We counted from 0 being proper developers over at Application Security Weekly. So we're recording that this coming Friday, and then we hopefully will have a standalone iTunes podcast that you can actually reach and listen to every week. So yeah, check it out.
Excellent. I wish you all the success in the world. Well, maybe not all the success in the world, because I want to keep some success for myself. But we do certainly wish you a lot of success with that one, my friend. Keith Hoodlett, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about some of the work you and your team have been doing to, help people communicate remediation advice to their development teams. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Glad to be here.
That was Keith Hoodlett of BugCrowd there. Big thanks to BugCrowd for sponsoring the Risky Business podcast. They've got a Soapbox edition coming up next month too, which should be a lot of fun. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.